Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
We were standing there for 4 days, told that absolutely we did not have clearance, our names weren't on the list.
Members of another Code Pink delegation are making slow progress into Gaza, where they hope to deliver humanitarian aid. We hear from delegation leaders Sandra Roosh of Canada and Pam Rasmussen of the U.S. Then Marjorie Cohn, president of the National Lawyers Guild, offers her reaction to President Barack Obama's appointment of U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court.
She has a strong record on civil rights cases, ruling for plaintiffs in cases of disability, sex and race discrimination, and affirmative action.
On April 20th, Sandra Roosh spoke to the Canadian-Palestine Parliamentary Association about the desperate needs in Gaza. When she joined us by phone from Gaza, she explained that things hadn't gotten any better there. Roosh and other Canadian delegates had waited 4 days to cross into Gaza. The Toronto Star, a Canadian newspaper, reported that the delegates had received clearance and support from senior Egyptian authorities, but they were turned away from Gaza's border time and time again anyway. And we have Sandra Roosh on the phone with us from Gaza. Sandra, are you able to hear us okay?
Yes.
Just explain what members of the Canadian delegation hope to do in Gaza.
Unfortunately, we're only going to have a day because a lot of us have flights back on the 29th. So we need to exit Gaza on the 28th. So tomorrow is our day, and we have brought some medical supplies and some uniforms for a soccer team and some other toys for children. But the main reason that we're making this trip is to bring attention to the fact that Gaza is still under siege, Gaza is still under attack, and we just want to make sure that everybody knows that it hasn't ended and that the people in Gaza need their help.
And Sandra, have you been to Gaza before?
Yes, I went with Code Pink in March. And after that, and after seeing the way the situation was, I knew that I wanted to bring back a delegation from Canada.
And what is your hope in this delegation? Is it to help people understand the conditions in Gaza?
Yes. You know, the conditions are horrendous. But the main thing is the condition of the siege, the locked gates, the fact that people can't come in and people can't come out. Why would it take 4 days for 9 Canadians to go in to bring medical aid and to show solidarity with the people of Palestine? You know, why were most of the people in the convoy from the Project Hope a couple of days before, why did they spend practically 24 hours inside the terminal and so many of them get turned away? And, you know, why can't Palestinians come in and out of their own area?
Is there any specific location you're looking forward to seeing?
Yeah. We're going up to the Jabalia refugee camp. We're going to meet with a youth group there that we've bought our sport uniforms for, soccer uniforms, soccer balls. So we're going to take a look at that area. What we're doing is we're heading up north, which was the area that was most affected by the massacre that occurred in December, January. So we're going to visit those areas. You know, when you only have 24 hours, you can't do everything that we had planned. We had hoped to sit down with a lot of humanitarian agencies, but that's become a little bit difficult. So we met with a Dr. Yusuf Musa. He's the executive director of the Union of Health Work Committees in Gaza. And after Jabalia, we'll also go to an area called Zatuna, but that type of travel is going to take up most of our day. And we're meeting with some women that I met on our trip before that work with UNRWA.
What have you heard from Dr. Musa? I know the UN has been saying, and UNRWA has been saying, that conditions, health conditions are getting worse.
It just seems so desperate because basic things that people need, just the feeling of feeling safe in your home, doesn't exist here. Nothing can come in and out. Simple things like jam and tomato sauce have been prohibited from coming into Gaza. I don't know what someone could do with jam and tomato sauce except enjoy them. So the situation is worse. We saw a little boy at the border one full day that we were there, and we really don't know how that story ended up. He was wearing a hospital gown. He has kidney disease, and he had a broken arm standing at the gate of Rafah. Palestinian boy trying to get back into his home in Gaza all day, standing in the hot sun with no answer as to whether he'd be able to go home or not. So how can the medical situations not be getting worse when people can't come and go freely to get the medical care that they need?
What about the delegations in general? I know there was concern that no one would get in.
Well, it took us 4 days to get in. We were standing there for 4 days, told that absolutely we did not have clearance, our names weren't on the list. Every single day that we were there, my group of the 9 Canadian delegates, and then soon after joined by the 38 students, and then by the Code Pink group that came from New York, I believe it's about 15. Every day, each one of us told something different about why we couldn't get in. No chance. You can't stay here. You have to go. This morning at 8:30, we were turned away at the first checkpoint between Al Arish and Rafah and told that there was military exercises going on and that we were not allowed to go down the road. And I asked, well, I see other cars going. Where are they going? They're going to villages that are along the way. Okay, well, let us go and wait in one of those villages. No, we have our orders. You can't go. We were told to turn back. And we saw the military vehicles, and we also saw them leave as we left.
You're talking about the Israeli military?
No, Egyptian military. Because we were on the Egyptian side, and it was the Egyptians today and for the last 4 days that were preventing us from going into Gaza. We don't see any Israeli presence here yet.
The Jabalia refugee camp Sandra Roush plans to visit houses a population of 195,249 refugees, according to the UN. An enthusiastic Code Pink founder, Medea Benjamin, reported via her blog that in addition to the Canadians, a delegation of 66 more humanitarian delegates have gotten into Gaza. We reached Code Pink's Pam Rasmussen in Cairo, where she was still trying to get the next group of 70 people in by Saturday. Rasmussen's group is coordinated by the Bay Area chapter of Code Pink. They're carrying $15,000 worth of playground equipment, school supplies, and toys for the children of Gaza.
We want to continue our work to get more and more Americans and other foreign nationals to see for themselves firsthand the conditions there, how very ordinary and wonderful the Palestinian people are, and to take that knowledge back home and to educate their family members, their friends, the media. You know, one thing we asked a commitment of from everybody that participates is to go back and present to community groups. You know, all of us who went in March have done hundreds of presentations to everything from churches to women's clubs to peace groups to synagogues, telling people of the perspective that is not getting out there. It amazes me the stereotypes that people have in the U.S. but elsewhere as well about Palestinians as a people and about Hamas. You know, I'm not an apologist for Hamas by any stretch of imagination, but there's a lot of myths out there, a lot of people who see it as too much of a black and white and all the faults on one side, and they don't recognize the part that our own country has played, for instance. And we need to understand that so we can be better mediators if we're going to be helping peace come to the region. We can't see it as a black and white situation.
Now, so much of Gaza, already devastated by years of conflict, was destroyed in the bombing. What is the argument for delay in reconstruction and getting aid in?
It's a very good question. It makes me think that there must be other reasons at work. Usually the explanation that you hear is from Israel and from the other governments and countries supporting them that there's a security concern. That, oh, this is all because they have to stop the rockets that Hamas was shooting at Israel. However, you know, you can only conclude once you learn about the situation, that if they were really worried about security, this is the last thing they should be doing. Like I said, they're raising an entire generation of people to be desperate and to hate. One thing I always try to tell my fellow Americans when I am home is if you try to put yourself in their shoes for a minute. And I have a very hard time believing that any American in that situation, growing up in those conditions, wouldn't want to go to any extreme to help their children, for instance, have a better life and to relieve the situation. So this is not helping security. I'm not quite sure, actually, what the real motivation is. It makes no sense to me at all.
Now, of course, the kind of person-to-person contact you're having with Palestinians in Gaza, bringing in aid, making friends, you're actually discouraging people from violence, but to rather fight for their rights in different ways.
Right. And one significant way that the U.S. has contributed to the conflict there is that most of the aid that we give to the region, all the countries in the region, is military aid. My own opinion is none of the countries, none of the people in the region need any more military aid. We should be giving humanitarian aid and building up the civilian institutions. I suppose if you look at the package that Congress is celebrating, $840 million that helped the Palestinians, is the way it was put, but only $300 million of that is going to Gaza because of concern for not helping Hamas. The rest is going to the West Bank, and most of it is military, building up the security forces in Mahmoud Abbas's government. And then you have the other situation is that Israel gets more military aid than any other country that we help, and it's all unconditional. So I'm trying to be even-handed here. I don't think Abbas needs any military aid. I don't think Israel does either. I think that we should be giving more civilian assistance, and any aid we give, like to Israel, should be conditional on meeting the commitments that both sides make. We hear a lot about what the Palestinians haven't done in terms of meeting their commitments, but very little said about the fact that Israel has not met it by any such imagination. That applies to Gaza, and it applies to the West Bank as well. So, you know, the U.S. is playing a role by being basically the biggest supplier of funds for more arms. It's the last thing that region needs.
Talk about the delegation. I know you have some high-profile people with you trying to get into Gaza as well. Dr. Patch Adams, for example, and Dr. Norman Finkelstein, the scholar.
I mean, we have a number of people whose names are well-known, including Patch Adams, who will try to get in through Israel to try to bring his healing touch through clowning to the kids of Gaza. But we also have Norman Finkelstein, who's going to try to enter through Egypt, who is a very well-known Jewish professor who has been very much criticized for being critical of Israel's policies. So we do have some pretty high-profile people in both delegations trying to get in. But I also want to recognize, including a number of Canadians, some people that are just, you know, everyday, ordinary, you know, people, housewives, teachers, social workers, who have really put aside their professions, who have scraped together scarce funds because they want to show their solidarity with the people in Gaza and bring their experience back to their home communities. And I think they need to be recognized as much as the people who are more well-known.
Finally, are you at all encouraged by the meeting between Barack Obama and Israel's right-wing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu? At least a little bit of pressure on Netanyahu there. Are you encouraged?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some signs for encouragement, both in Obama's choice of George Mitchell to be his envoy to the region and the fact that at least Obama is saying some things that would lead me to believe that perhaps he will lean harder on Israel to meet his commitments. I still think we have a long way to go before we really changed our tune a little bit in that respect, and we certainly have a challenge with Netanyahu in office. From what I can tell, Israel really has taken a turn to the right, so the big challenge is going to take a very strong president and Congress to keep standing up to Israel in that way. I'm hopeful that Obama will do that, but I think I'm reserving judgment a little bit to see if he follows through.
Pam Rasmussen, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Pam Rasmussen and other Code Pink delegates visiting Gaza to deliver toys, school supplies, and materials to build 3 playgrounds. You can follow their progress online at womensaynotowar.org.
And when Sonia Sotomayor ascends those marble steps to assume her seat on the highest court of the land, America will have taken another important step towards realizing the ideal that is etched above its entrance: equal justice under the law.
You have nominated me to serve on the country's highest court, and I am deeply moved.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dory Smith.
Do you believe that the president has a commander-in-chief override to authorize or excuse the use of torture and interrogation of enemy prisoners even though there may be domestic and international laws prohibiting the specific practice.
Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy questioning Chief Justice Roberts during his confirmation hearings in 2005.
Senator, I believe that no one is above the law under our system, and that includes the president. The president is fully bound by the law, the Constitution, and statutes.
Do you feel that you'd be able to interpret the Bill of Rights the same, whether we're in wartime or not?
I do, Senator. The obligation of the court to protect those basic liberties in times of peace and in times of war, in times of stress and in times of calm, that doesn't change.
Americans are about to hear another confirmation hearing for Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the U.S. Supreme Court. We turn to Marjorie Cohn, president of the National Lawyers Guild, for her reaction to the Sotomayor appointment. She is author of Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent, and Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. Marjorie Cohn, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Dory.
Now, in an article republished in Huffington Post, Roberto Lovato of New American Media has advised Judge Sotomayor to remember it's not she who will be on trial during her confirmation hearings, but in fact, the Republican Party. If we do recall other confirmation hearings, we can get a sense of what he means there. But what do you see as the most important questions now for Judge Sotomayor?
Well, I think that it's very significant that President Obama has nominated the first Latino to the Supreme Court. She will double the number of women on the high court. She will not significantly change the political balance of the court, although it's impossible to predict for sure. She will be, I think, similar in her rulings to Justice Souter. But I think that an important issue to focus on is the accusation by many right-wingers that Judge Sotomayor is a judicial activist, judging from the bench or legislating from the bench. And this is disingenuous and hypocritical coming from the right wing, because I can't think of a greater example of judicial activism than Bush versus Gore, where a conservative majority of the Supreme Court effectively handed the election to George W. Bush. Judges engage in activism all the time. They don't judge in a vacuum. They judge in light of their experiences and their worldview. And in fact, when Justice Scalia interprets gun rights under the Second Amendment, he is engaging in judicial activism. When Chief Justice John Roberts opposes abortion rights, he is engaging in judicial activism. And if it weren't for judicial activism, the civil rights movement would not have seen the success that it did. So I think it's important to denounce these criticisms of Judge Sotomayor for being a judicial activist as a red herring and as being hypocritical.
If you just reflect on some of the issues you've been working on at the National Lawyers Guild, what do you think is going to be most affected or impacted if Judge Sotomayor is confirmed? I mean, can you think of the range of issues here? Torture, executive privilege, on and on.
Judge Sotomayor doesn't really have much of a record on executive power, and certainly issues of interrogation policies, preventive detention, state secrets will come before her. And they will most likely come before her if she is confirmed to the court, to the high court. So we don't know what her record would be on those issues. But she has shown strong support for First Amendment rights, including the right to free speech and assembly. She has a strong record on civil rights cases, ruling for plaintiffs in cases of disability, sex and race discrimination, and affirmative action. She struck down a strip search of a girl at a juvenile detention center. And the things that she said when she made that ruling were reminiscent of things that Justice Ginsburg said during oral argument in a very similar case that's pending before the Supreme Court right now, which involved the strip search of a 13-year-old girl who was suspected of having ibuprofen at school. And Judge Sotomayor in the case in which she wrote the dissent and said that the majority had not been sensitive enough to the privacy interests of emotionally troubled children who have been victims of abuse or neglect and might be more vulnerable and mentally and emotionally than other youths of their age. And she talked about how embarrassing and humiliating the searches of these girls in this Connecticut detention center must have been. And I think the fact that she and Justice Ginsburg, both women, both focusing on what these girls must be going through, I think brings a unique perspective to the court that the male members may not have.
New York Times has sort of run through a few of her cases. One case that really is of interest is McKesko v. Correctional Services Corporation. Sotomayor argued that extending Bivens liability to reach private corporations would further its overriding purpose, which she found was to provide redress for violations of constitutional rights, that in cases where there are lawsuits from the public against companies working for the federal government. That's a very interesting case to discuss now, isn't it? Because when he appointed her, President Obama noted her strength in that area of the private sector and corporate law.
Yes, and I think she has gone both ways in protecting corporations and affirming challenges to corporations, and which makes me think that she would be even-handed and call it as she sees it, and given the fact that she does have a background as a corporate lawyer.
Like Barack Obama does.
Well, he has a very short career as a corporate lawyer. Actually, no, I don't think he does have a career as a corporate lawyer. He was a community organizer, and I think he might have clerked for a summer in a big firm, but his background is much more in public interest work, that's my understanding.
Am I right to assume that it is the most difficult challenge, I think, for a private citizen to try to sue a company working for the federal government? I mean, we've seen a lot of instances where people have failed at this in many different settings, environmental, economic, or again, in terms of companies like Blackwater. I think it's the family members that are now trying to sue. What do you think about that direction for thinking now? I mean, what kinds of things can people work on, let's say, if they're going to perceive this new member, Judge Sotomayor, on the high court?
We're going to have to see case by case what the facts are and what the particular statutes are that she's construing. But certainly one would hope that in spite of the fact that she has a background as a corporate lawyer, she will be sensitive to the little guy who is taking on the big corporation or taking on the federal government. And as I said, she has ruled for plaintiffs in disability cases, in discrimination cases. And a very good example, I think, is the baseball strike case. She was a trial judge at the time, and the owners had locked out the players, effectively bringing baseball to a halt. And she ruled in favor of the players and against the owners and said, you have to let those players back in. And that's, I think, a very good example of her standing up to corporate power and ruling in favor of labor. I wouldn't say that baseball players are the little guys, but they were labor as opposed to management.
Attorney Cohn, Troy Davis is on Georgia's death row. The 11th Circuit Court there has turned down his request for a new trial. His attorneys now hoping the U.S. Supreme Court will order a new hearing. But about the death penalty, we've seen dramatic changes in states like Connecticut, more receptiveness to abolishing the death penalty as unworkable, as expensive. Can you offer us your insights into these issues as well?
Well, I see what used to be overwhelming support for the death penalty waning. I think there's still majority support for the death penalty, but as states one at a time abolish the death penalty, and as it becomes clear that, in fact, innocent people are executed or released after 17, 20 years on death row because DNA evidence or third-party confessions have exonerated them, people are going to lose confidence in the death penalty. And it's not just the cases of factual innocence, proven innocence. Columbia did a study fairly recently which showed that I think 67% of all cases, federal cases, were reversed on appeal, death penalty cases were reversed on appeal for serious constitutional error. And you have some states such as Georgia where a death penalty case from start to finish can last for 2 days, where they don't have the resources to make the right to counsel meaningful and where people are railroaded into death penalties. So I think that as this becomes clearer, we're going to see more and more states abolish the death penalty. Now, in terms of Judge Sotomayor, she has not issued any major decisions on the death penalty. She was a career prosecutor. Well, she was a prosecutor for 5 years, an assistant district attorney, and you have to enforce the death penalty when you're a district attorney, but not all district attorneys favor the death penalty. So we'll see. I'm sure that her views on the death penalty will be fodder for the Republicans when they're questioning her on the Senate Judiciary Committee and in the Senate.
What is the National Lawyers Guild position on disbarring lawyers who approved of torture? That's an ongoing effort, and we're conducting interviews for upcoming programs on this topic, and also on the question of war crimes in Gaza. In the background, as Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas is visiting Washington to meet with Barack Obama, we have Judge Goldstone meeting with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon about their investigations into war crimes by Israel and or Palestinians in Gaza. What's the position of the Guild on these questions?
Your comment about disbarring lawyers, the National Lawyers Guild was first to call for the disbarment of John Yoo for his participation in justifying and rationalizing torture, which violates our laws, constitutes war crimes. And a National Lawyers Guild lawyer filed a complaint with the state bar in Pennsylvania where he is licensed to practice. That complaint has been dismissed pending the release of the report from the Office of Professional Responsibility, which it is rumored is quite critical of him and his work. The National Lawyers Guild in San Francisco filed a complaint against William Haynes, another one of the so-called torture lawyers. So we support, the National Lawyers Guild supports a special prosecutor to investigate and prosecute Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, and the other officials who authorized the torture policy, in addition to the lawyers who are the legal mercenaries, I guess you would say, who gave them legal cover, so to speak. In terms of the Middle East and Gaza, the National Lawyers Guild sent a delegation to Gaza after Israel's recent attack on Gaza and came up with some original and very interesting report and video footage that no one else has come back with that can be accessed at www.nlg.org. And we, in fact, sent that and a white paper on Gaza on the law regarding Israel's incursion into Gaza to Justice Goldstone, who was appointed by the UN to investigate these war crimes by Israel in Gaza. So I commend to people our website, www.nlg.org, and if you click on that, you will see right away the report of our delegation from Gaza and the white paper.
Marjorie Cohn, your book, Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. The website says it's due out in winter of 2009. Can you be more specific?
Yes, it has been published. It was published last month. You can get that on Amazon. I co-authored it with Kathleen Gilbert, who is an expert on military administrative law. It analyzes the GI movement, which was really the apex of the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War, and contrasts it to resistance by soldiers and sailors in today's military, resistance to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, conscientious objection, discharges, racism in the military, sexism and sexual assault in the military. So it is both an analysis of how to end those occupations and a practical guide to soldiers and sailors about how to assert their rights to dissent, fight racism, receive discharges, get conscientious objector status, etc.
Marjorie Cohn is president of the National Lawyers Guild and an expert on international human rights and U.S. foreign policy. Marjorie Cohn, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Dory.
The website for the National Lawyers Guild, where you can find the film Attorney Marjorie Cohn mentioned, online, nlg.org. And we'll link to that on our website. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program produced at Talk Nation Radio Studios in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. And look for us on Twitter.